Welcome to Surf Splendor. I'm your host, David Scales. The subject of today's episode is a newly released surf film called Let's Be Frank. Surf film, it's an important medium to surfing that was really ignited by The Endless Summer, seminal surf film from the early 60s. Sure, surf films came before that, but The Endless Summer really launched careers and inspired generations of filmmakers, and really the influence of The Endless Summer is hard to track. It's so ubiquitous in surf culture. Although it wasn't really my Citizen Kane, I was raised in the 90s. I was a Taylor Steele fan. Somebody who, by the way, I've been emailing with for years trying to get on this podcast. He's actually agreed to come on this podcast. It's just that in the 3 years that we've been emailing, our schedules have not quite aligned, believe it or not. But incidentally, Taylor's new film project, Proximity, looks like it'll be really incredible. They're doing a lot of advertising and kind of little trailers leading up to the film, behind-the-scenes stuff, so you could find all of that on YouTube. Anyway, growing up in the 90s, I was a huge Taylor Steele fan. I was a Tony Roberts fan. I was a Bill Ballard fan. I was a huge Lost Enterprises fan. And what surf film represented in my youth has died. The formula and the structure is basically the same as it was then, but that's the precise problem for me. I have evolved into a more nuanced human being than I was in the early 90s. And surfing means something different to me now. And there's been no one making films that resonate with my current surf experience. What has died in surf films is the ability to transport me to a different time and place. I felt like I was on the road with Spike in that Lost film, or I felt like I was going to Costa Rica to meet Robert August in the summer too. For the past decade, and now certainly with the internet, I've been desensitized by endless spinning barrels at unknown tropical reef breaks with cutaway shots of swaying palm trees and G-stringed beauties. We, as a surf culture, have really hit our saturation point years ago with surf content and visuals. And yet every year, the biggest surf productions follow the exact same formula. Better waves, better surfing, mixed with a few interviews, and perhaps some narration. Yes, surf films, edits, clips, as we call them now, because they're not film length, they look better than they've ever looked. The technology is better, the cameras are better, and the surfing is obviously a lot better. But it's just a better degree of what came before. The art form, the medium of surf film, has largely stagnated. Now, it's easy to complain about, which I often do on this podcast, but I want to offer a solution. It's a solution that I've actually offered on this podcast as well. And I think that the solution for modern surf filmmakers is simply story. Tell better stories. Tell stories creatively. Take the lead from Hollywood, from non-surf documentary. Take the lead from books. All of those mediums focus their projects on story. Story never gets old. And the best news is we, as this collective community of surfers, we have the best stories to tell. We have the best characters. Surfing is infinitely interesting. It's death-defying. It requires an athletic and nomadic lifestyle full of sacrifice and adventure. Why don't we have better storytellers documenting these things? Or maybe we do. I'd argue that we actually do have great storytellers, but their mouths, their pens, their cameras are bound by the structure of our industry and of our media outlets being funded by the brands whose dirty laundry good stories might air out. But that's an entirely different tangent. And I digress. All of this rant you've heard before. I've been saying it for years, but I'm thrilled to say that my rant will end today with the release of Let's Be Frank. Peter Hamblin and his team of creatives have produced the most inventive surf film ever created. And it's squarely focused on story. The story of Frank Solomon. Or, correction, the story is an attempt to discover who is Frank. The story has structure, plot points. It's partially scripted, partially acted. The concept is actually a little difficult for me to explain here, so I'd actually advise you to stop this podcast now, watch the film, then come back and listen to this interview. You'll probably appreciate this more in that sequence. Now, Peter's influences in the film are pretty easy to spot. The camera movements, the art direction, even the tone is nearly a replica of a lot of Wes Anderson's work. The fight sequence is straight out of a Guy Ritchie film. But those really aren't even critiques of Let's Be Frank, to be honest. Those devices, those techniques work perfectly with the narrative that Peter crafted. And influence aside, the film just looks beautiful. It's straight up entertaining, and most importantly, it's fun. One legitimate critique does exist, but it only exists if you view Let's Be Frank as a surf film. And that critique is that there isn't enough surfing, and that the surfing that is in the film isn't really on par with the top surf films of the year, nor the top surfing being done on the WSL tours. That, however, really didn't bother me at all, to be honest, because it could be argued that this isn't even really a surf film. If it is, it redefines the genre, but to be honest, it qualifies just as a film on its own. And let me back up. Frank surfs great. He's not John Florence, who, by the way, plays a major role in this film as well, but Frank's surfing is beautiful throughout each segment of the film, and truthfully, the vast majority of the film's viewing audience won't be able to identify the nuance of difference between Frank's top turn or a Kelly Slater top turn. But this is a surfing podcast, and I'd be remiss to not mention the surfing in the film. Anyway, my name is David Scales. This is Surf Splendor, and this is my conversation with Peter Hamblin and Frank Solomon. Enjoy the show. Firstly, I think it's such a complete vision from a vision that's executed more completely, I think, than any other project that I've really seen. From the script to every bit of marketing material that came out, it just seems like there was a concept in mind and we're executing this concept. Whose idea? Where did the original seed come from, and what was the original concept for the film? Who developed it?
So you nailed it. In reality, every part of the film and the crew that we worked with, we've taken it from concept development all the way through to the finished product, to the premieres. We really have. There's been a lot of thought that's been applied to everything. The original concept of the film came in when I had just finished my first film, which was Right Side of Wrong, which is a 15-minute short.
Right.
And I was out one night. It was that evening of the screening, and I met up with Frank, and I'd never met Frank before. Through social media and stuff, I had a preconceived idea of who he was. And okay. Especially, I said this the other day, especially on the South African rand,
right.
It doesn't allow you to travel much. It doesn't allow you to do much. And I was looking at Frank, and Frank was kind of like traveling and cruising the world. So I kind of started throwing these ideas out to Frank, maybe he's got this massive sponsorship deal in place, so on and so forth. And he basically shut me down and said, no, that's not how it is. And this is how I get around the world. This is how I travel and make money. And we'd had a couple of beers, and the reality was that we came up, I think, within the first 5 minutes. I was like, dude, we should make a film about you, and we should call it Let's Be Frank. Let's be real. Let's show the real side of things. At that time, it was just an idea to create a 15-minute piece. It was never going to be something big. The next day, I woke up, and I phoned him, and I was like, dude, there might be something to this. Like, let's do it. And the more I chatted to him, the more I chatted to his friends and stuff like that, the more we realized that there's a lot more to tell. And that's why the project that was going to be like 3 weeks became 3 years. And I was dead set on not making a film like I had in the past. Everything I'd done in the past was go out and shoot it, and come back to the edit suite and then try and make the story out.
Figure out what the raw material is exactly.
That's not very kind of, from a creative level, that's not satisfying, because right. There was so much more that I wanted to do with it. And And that's why I started initially just starting to script the pieces together. First coming up with what the twist is, what the twist of the film is. Like, what is it? What does it land itself on? And the conspiracy theory was, that's how I wanted to tell it. Yeah. I didn't want to tell the static template of, this is Frank, this is what he does. I found that boring and I wanted to do more. So that's exactly why I needed that hook. And that hook was the conspiracy theory. And then it just... Once you've got that, then it kind of just grows itself. And, okay. And that's exactly what happened. And I just kept on writing, and I probably wrote for about a year. And again, waiting for the moments of inspiration, not just forcing the writing, waiting, like coming up with an idea and going, okay, cool, let's write that, let's tie that all together.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I did. And it took about a year and a bit to write.
The script itself was remarkable.
Thank you.
Appreciate yeah, truly. That, cool. And I mean... It's hilarious as well. Like, above and beyond everything else, it's just funny.
I think, sorry, just saying what Pete said, and to his credit, like, we didn't have a big budget to start. And we got a certain amount from Red Bull, I think, in the beginning, like a small amount. And, you know, I thought, like, that was it. We're going to make that work, whatever. And I think we spent that all in one scene.
Really?
Yeah. We made a trailer with all the budget that we had, pretty yeah. much. And I don't know if you've seen the trailer, but it's pretty much me like watering the ground. That was the first one, and it was.
I didn't see that.
It was how long? Like,
yeah, it wasn't a trailer. It was like we used it to try and get furthest one.
But that's kind of what got it in the end, wasn't it? Yeah, people exactly, saw yeah. that and they're like, "What is this?" Like,
because the concept or the final product, anyways, I can't imagine you could even pitch that to somebody. If you sat down with Bob Hurley and we were like, "Hey, here's our idea." He won't understand it to the level to which you execute.
Yeah, it was the hardest thing in the world, and that's exactly.
And actually,
what
it's been really hard that part because even just like telling my friends at home, like, "Oh, I'm making this film," they're like, "Oh, whatever, bro." Like, but some of my friends still don't believe me. I made a film. They think if they are, they think it's just someone with like a 5D filming me to try and explain like the stuff that we've been through is pretty tough.
But and a lot of the nuance is going to fall on deaf ears because, like, just little transitions of the camera zooming into your eyeball and that goes into a wave and that goes... Like, most people don't understand all the work that's involved in that, and there's a million of those transitions throughout the film, you know?
Yeah, it's huge. That whole process, even when we're trying to pitch to Red Bull, like, the only way I could do that to really show them what I meant was to actually cut a scene together. And that's what right. I did. So I cut like two of the scenes together. And I think the first one we cut was, wasn't the fight scene. It was, I think it was the seal scene when he jumps into the water and just show exactly how that kind of works and how the fiction, non-fiction work together.
Yeah.
And then when they started seeing it and visualizing it, they were like, "Oh, hang on, you could be onto something here. This could be really cool."
Right. So I guess the first follow-up question is just how close is the final product to what your vision was?
Bang on.
Really?
Exactly what it was.
Yeah. Really?
We weren't cutting any corners here. Like,
okay. That's what I was trying to say. Yeah. So that's what I was trying to say with that first scene. And it's when I was really, like, when we did finally get a bit of budget, I think you blew that all as well, didn't you, the fight scene? Like,
yeah.
We went all, like, when I got to the set, first of all, I was in London, like, training for 2 weeks for that fight scene with stunt guys from Vikings that had done... Sherlock Holmes fight scene and
yeah, a guy called Richard Ryan. Yeah. Richard Ryan is a stunt coordinator. He got in there. Yeah, everything we did, like
it was
every
like,
single
scene. I think that you wanted that from the beginning, didn't you? Yeah. He wanted to do like he's like, "If we're gonna do it, we're gonna do it 100%.
It's a spectacular sequence.
Yeah.
But I'm just curious, how'd you even get him involved?
Just hustling really and just I'd spoken to like a number of different stunt choreographers and none of them would allow me to punch people in the face because of health and safety and everything like that. And I was like, "There's no way, man! Like these guys are definitely hitting each other in this film." So,
like in
Sherlock Holmes and the Snatch and all of that.
Right.
So I just looked up who the stunt choreographer was. I reached out to his agent. His agent got me a conversation with him, and I just kind of pitched it to him, and he just loved the idea. So it was very lucky. And he also, we didn't have budget; we couldn't afford him. So he agreed to do it for next to nothing.
Crazy.
And ended up sending a crew out to kind of train Frank and do the whole thing. And it was amazing.
It's funny because you said we started out with a very small budget and then what we got from Red Bull, we blew through. And I heard you saying something, I think, similar on with the Surfer Magazine interview that you did. but it looks like it has a huge budget. I mean, the final product looks remarkable, you know? It looks much more like a Hollywood film than a surf film in terms of production value.
Yeah, we didn't, like, from a budget perspective, it really wasn't. I think if you want to look at the input that's coming from all the people and in kind.
That's a lot of money.
They are. In kind and the favors. Then it's a lot of money, because when you make films, you got to pay for people's time.
Exactly.
And literally everyone who got involved, and there was a core crew of, I think, five of us, everyone got involved, they did it for free. Like, wow. No one got paid a cent. That's really, and the thing is as well, Matthew Day, who's our DP.
I was going to say, like, a big reason for why the film looks the way it does visually is Matthew's, skills is pretty crazy on lighting and setting up the camera. He comes from a studio background.
100%, yeah.
And like when people are like, let's do it, like he's used to running around. Like, and Matt's like, took like an hour to set up lights.
Yeah.
But in the end, you know, you can see why. Yeah. It looks so amazing.
Yeah. Well, and he's got a whole studio in London that he kind of runs. So all his equipment, everything like that, was just a massive savings, financial savings for us. We didn't really have much money at all. I know there's been some numbers floating around. I don't know where people get the numbers from, but none of those numbers are correct. We had a much smaller budget than that.
Well, what I've found, maybe this is true for the guy choreographing the fight scene, is that people are just enamored by surfing, and people in high profile positions in Hollywood or whatever, they just want to dabble in the surf world a little bit, you know, and say that they did it. And so I find that the surf industry benefits from a bit of that. You know?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, they're intrigued by it.
People are trying to sell the lifestyle. You know?
Yeah.
By the surf lifestyle.
Yeah.
And,
You were saying one of the initial conversations or interests that you had in Frank was just, hey, man, how do you travel the world? We're living on the RAN, and how does that translate? How did you do it? I mean, being in the surf industry, we all know how other people do it, but a lot of listeners to the podcast are just working professionals. Yeah. How does it work for a young guy from South Africa?
Yeah, I would say drugs on porn.
Yeah, to the movie will have you believe. But no, I just, I went to university and stuff, and I had to do like a year of like normal work, you know? Mm-hmm. Like normal work, but I was working construction for like a year, and I was like, I'm not going to do this. You know, this is not
trying to be a pro surfer at the same time.
No, I was just, I didn't think I'd be a pro surfer.
Oh, okay.
But I was doing like, you know, a regular job.
Right.
And so I think for me, like anything, like a lot of guys are pro surfers and then have to get a regular job.
Right.
And, I think for me, like the hustling thing was all right, because anything was better than sitting in like a container on a construction site, like counting bricks, you know? So
totally.
No matter how hard it was, and it was some really hard times, it was fine, because it was like, okay, well, you know, it could be worse.
Well, you're going to hustle either way.
Yeah, exactly.
Either hustling and surfing or hustling in construction.
But I worked, man. I just worked. Everyone works, you know? So I worked selling Christmas trees, like people say, like waiting tables, delivering vegetables, working in Hawaii on the farms in Haleiwa, working at home, like doing adventure tours and stuff. Just doing odd jobs.
So when you guys linked up and you had been traveling the world, you were funding that traveling with doing the odd jobs.
I was funding it, and I honestly, like, I made a semi-conscious effort never to like say that I was working. I knew subconsciously that like if you were gonna like sell this dream, which what Peter kind of saw, that saying that I was working and it was so hard, and people don't want to feel sorry for you. I mean, everyone's got to work. Like, so I've never like made a big deal about the fact that I was working. I just did it. And then when I was like in San Francisco, oh, look how cool the Golden Gate Bridge is. And then Mavericks is super good today. But I was never like, oh my gosh, I have to work as well. Because people just have to work.
Totally.
Yeah.
I think that's probably part of the conversation we had that one night.
Yeah.
Because the way... that's exactly what we didn't want to do with the film. We didn't want to do it in the way that, like, oh, let's feel sorry for Frank. That's not really what we're trying to do. And that's not what he was trying to push either. Because I think I've seen a couple of films that are out there, and the guys, they really kind of focus on the hardship. And everyone has hardship.
Yeah,
it's really more about kind of like showing the tenacity that it takes. And, I mean, it doesn't exist in the surf world. I don't know. Well, from my experience, it doesn't exist that a lot of the pro surfers and stuff are out there working and trying to make it work. Maybe a bit more in the big wave world, but
yeah,
generally, there's a lot of money behind these guys. They live a good life. So,
especially you know? Where we're sitting right now in Southern California. Yeah. It's like...
Yeah. And I like this view, like jet skis and boats and all that. It looks crazy.
Well, so that gives us a little bit of Frank's background. What's your background, Peter, as a filmmaker?
Porn.
also, you're sitting in the right place.
I was actually not involved in filming at all. I studied and studied marketing and advertising, and I was in advertising for about 10 years.
Mm.
And I think the same thing. I just hated it. I hated being involved in advertising. I hated going and being bound to a desk every day.
What
and,
industry were you in? Like, was it related to the surf industry
no,
at all?
Not at all. No.
You guys were doing work.
I was in London, based in London.
Oh,
and
okay.
I was working in advertising. So, ad agency. And I worked for a number of different ad agencies. And then I actually set up my own little ad agency in South Africa in Durban for a while. And just really didn't enjoy that. I just felt that kind of like stifling on creativity and stuff like that, and I wanted to be more creative. And then I picked up a camera like maybe about 6 years ago now. Oh no, maybe a little bit more. Maybe about 8 years ago. I just had an interest in taking photos. And the more I took photos, the more I enjoyed it. And then I was Pierre Tosti. He was
ASP photographer.
Yeah, exactly. He was the ASP photographer, and I was like, dude, that would be cool. Like, I love surfing. I want to go and shoot this. I kind of harassed him for like a good year, and eventually he gave me a break and he said, "Listen, Peter, you can come. We're in Mundaka. We're one photographer short. You can come and take a bit of the lifestyle photos, but we can't pay you, and you're gonna have to sort out your own accommodation."
Wow.
So I kind of did that, and I quit my job. And then I just ended up going and shooting with Karen Wilson. And I shot for 2 weeks. And the event ran the full 2 weeks. And Kelly Slater won his 8th world title. And I ended up getting shots of Kelly getting thrown off the wall. And I used that and I leveraged those photos to help me get more photo jobs in South Africa.
Got it.
So when I got back to South Africa, I just hit up all the surf brands. And I started doing like clothing shoots with them and all of that. And the long story short is that I came back to London and I was kind of working in back in advertising because that's paid the bills. But because of all the contacts I had, I was like, dude, I'm going to start taking photos for all these agencies and that. And that's what I did. So on the weekends, I started taking photos. That started making more money through taking photos than was in advertising. So then I eventually quit the advertising gig and I set up my production company in London, which was originally just event photos. That's what we used to do. And then the 5D came in, and the Canon 5D, you could do video. So I started messing around with the video a little bit more and just kind of grew and grew and grew. And I started then offering a video service to my clients. And then I was just kind of keen to do something different. And that's when I picked up Warwick Wright. I flew him out to Portugal and we spent a week in Portugal and I just filmed him. And then I came up with a concept afterwards and kind of tied it together. And that did really well. That was my first short film that I did, and I taught myself editing. And that did really well. We won at X-Dance, Best Short, Best Edit, and stuff like that. And then we got kind of a guy, Evan Fontaine, saw that edit, and he works at Red Bull Media House. And he gave me my opportunity to work on a series called The Ripple Effect, which was based on like key founders in the surfing industry. So we did a piece on like Bob Hurley.
Yeah, I remember that. That was really well done.
Cool, thank you.
I wanted to see more of them.
Well, they are. We've just actually released another six.
Oh,
they're on
great.
Red Bull TV now. We've just done one on O'Neill, one on GoPro. O'Neill, who was it? It was O'Neill. It was GoPro.
Fans.
No, it was Quicksilver. Sorry.
Vans.
Yeah, Vans. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, the hearing problem. Vans, Quicksilver, Surfline, Sean Collins, O'Neill, and GoPro.
They're all available now?
They're all available on Red Bull TV. They're awesome. And then we're actually taking that now into tech. So we're doing stuff with Wired Magazine. We're doing Twitch, Reddit, amazing artist called Robert Williams. Doing a piece on him as well. So, yeah, so that basically the ripple effect has kind of grown out and it's afforded us to travel a lot more. And then also, I suppose it afforded me as a company, it gave us a bigger budget to play with, and then we could input that into Let's Be Frank as well. So, a lot of the money that I've kind of like, money that we've made there, we've invested into Let's Be Frank and made that film.
It seems like, I was going to talk about influence. It seems like, you know, your first foray into surf film, The Right Side of Wrong, is that what it was? wasn't a reflection of other surf films. It almost had more Hollywood influence in it than anything else. Like, I could see Hollywood filmmakers that whose influence is infused through your stuff, but not a lot of representation of the surf world that I see in your films. What did you grow up watching, and what were you inspired by?
Yeah, I definitely grew up watching a lot of, like, Taylor Steele and Bruce Brown kind of films. I think if you talk about in the surf industry where my influences come from, they come from definitely Taylor Steele, definitely Joe G. I mean, Joe G, I don't know if you saw Strange Rumblings, but that's an incredible film. I love that. I love the narrative. It's almost like an accolade to yesteryears. It's an amazing film. I think it's incredible. And then guys like Kai Neville are a massive influence to me. We've got very different styles, but the way that he hustles, and as an independent filmmaker, how he's revolutionized, like revolutionized surf filmmaking, and has got such a core following, and they literally have created like almost a lifestyle, him and his crew.
Totally.
And when I saw that, I was like, bro, if he can do it, like it motivates us to just try and reach out and try and make a film ourselves, because he's showing that there's a platform for independent filmmakers.
Totally.
And that's what blew my mind. So definitely from the surf perspective, there's those guys. But then obviously, I mean, I get it all the time with this. Like, there's a Wes Anderson influence. There's, I love Wes Anderson. I love that kind of dry, kind of centered approach to everything, very linear movements and everything like that. It's just, didn't feels right to me as a filmmaker to film like that. That makes sense to me. But then there's also like Guy Ritchie, who's incredible in his wit and his, script writing and stuff. It's just incredible. Like, there's so much humor that kind of narrate.
Right.
And then you've obviously like Quentin Tarantino, those kind of things. I love that, the edgier kind of dirty bits, but then I also love like Wes Anderson and that simplicity.
Yeah. Well, I've long complained on these microphones, in fact, about the state of surf film over the last 5 or 10 years, where like John John's film last year was amazing, but it was just degrees better than what had come before it. It wasn't revolutionary, you know, in terms of the style of filmmaking. The surfing was, and the cinematography was, but again, just degrees better than previous efforts. Yours, I felt, this film is completely unique. And again, incorporates a lot of the Hollywood stuff, but what I really have longed for is story. I always say, like, dude, what surf film really needs is better story. At best, you get some narration. Maybe some with an interview with the surfer. But your guys' script, and you actually did it really interestingly in that it's semi-fictional. Like, there's certainly a narrative throughout the entire film, but the way that the narrative is woven is interesting because there's a lot of reality in it. Like, you guys still go on surf trips. You still go Ireland, Mexico, Hawaii, like a normal surf film would, but the narrative and the way that it's told, what was the idea behind that, or how did you land at that? On that, I mean, we talked about the concept a little bit earlier, but lots of people have had the concept of, oh, let's do a profile film, and then they go do a profile film. But how did you land at the exact concept?
I think I'm a very impatient filmmaker, and it's relevant in all my styles. Like, you see the ripple effect. There's like in every ripple effect edit, there's like 1,000 shots where there would be nothing. So there's a sense of pace to it. But like the biggest reason why I think I'm impatient is that films to me are about entertainment.
Okay.
That's ultimately what it's about. It's like, if you go and sit in a theater, you want to be entertained. You don't want to be, and especially as a filmmaker, I don't want to watch people watch my films and be like looking or chatting or getting distracted. I want them to be caught and immersed in the moment, because that's ultimately what it is. And I think that was just the guiding principle to this film, is that it needs to be super entertaining. I want people to be guessing what's going to happen next. Like, what is going to happen next? Because in the first freaking 5 minutes, you've seen girls' tits. You've seen someone's hair get shot. Like, why would you even see that in the film? Like, and that now you're just waiting in anticipation for what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
So ultimately, we just wanted to make something that was truly lived in the entertainment world. And that's really what it was.
Well, what's funny is there's so much truth. Like, you could easily say, like, oh, it's a fictional storyline. But you tell the story of sponsorship and how people get sponsored through a lot of the humor. And the scene with Dan and Pat, that part of it is fictional. But the story that Pat's telling is true. You know, that is how you get sponsored. So I thought that that was really done well in that it's like actually very informative and educational, and somebody going who doesn't really know much about surfing can learn how you get to one place to the next on a budget or without a budget, and then how sponsorship happens and all that stuff. So really interesting.
I think also see a lot of Pete's like creativity, you know, like coming up with, you know, the idea of when I walk down the mountain and jump out and paddle dungeons, and he was like, we're going to follow this chick's ass, and it's going to be like a metaphor for when you're walking down the mountain. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Who would think of that?
I wouldn't have thought of that, exactly. But it's done.
I might have a perverted mind.
Yeah. It's done beautifully, though. Let's talk about the locations. I said, obviously, South Africa, Ireland, Mexico, Hawaii. Was there anywhere else?
Hawaii, California, Mexico, Cape Town.
Yeah.
Cape Town. Right. You broke your back in Ireland.
In Ireland, yeah.
In Mulligamore?
No, at Riley's in Ireland.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Some people were like, you know, saying like there's not a lot of surf footage in the film. They were like, there's not enough surf footage or whatever, but I don't know. It's not a regular surf film. So
right.
I don't think, you know, I wanted people to watch it with an open mind, you know, think of something different. Things don't always have to be just like they've been for the last 20 years, you know.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
I was conflicted with it. Like, as I was watching it, I was anticipating more surfing, but I resolved the conflict by I'm super entertained. Like you said, like, I actually thought there would be more, but I'm not bothered that there isn't, because, by the way, I could pull up my phone right now and watch surfing on Instagram nonstop. I don't need to come here and watch that. What I can't see on Instagram is this. You know? So, yeah. But there was enough surfing and enough, like, high-quality and heart-pounding surfing that it was worth it.
Yeah, you know? And even that's what I said in the speech. Like, I mean, I didn't do any airs.
Or, right.
You know, it's not a regular film. And, like you said, people, I mean, those top guys, they can do those airs all day.
Right.
And I mean, the surfing, it was challenging. I think it was one of the more challenging parts was getting surf footage, because obviously, like you said, we didn't have a big budget. So, like, having, like, a top surf filmer, someone who just films surfing, which is really hard to do if you don't know surfing.
Right.
That was kind of a tricky part, eh?
Because we all, like, had full-time jobs throughout the making of this film. So, I could never get away to somewhere.
Mexico for, like, a month.
Yeah. Just go and travel with Frank and shoot surfing, and I can shoot from the land, but I've never shot in the water.
Sure.
So we wanted to get the best people, and in order to do that, you need a lot of money. And there were waves, man. He caught the biggest, gnarliest wave, like, in Mulligamore, and we missed it.
No.
Our former missed it because he just did not have the experience of being on the back of a jet ski, and he shot amazing stuff, but it was just that one wave you missed.
Brutal.
There's snippets of it in the I think we got snippets of it, but we didn't get it as clean as we could have
been.
Well, let's talk about that trip specifically in Ireland, because you did break your back, and I wanted to get that story. But who were you there with, and what was that trip like?
Well, I went, the first year I went is when I broke my back.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But that footage is in the film.
Yeah, from the first year. So then, you know, the next year I went back is when I got better waves. Mm. But yeah, I wanted to go there because it was something different and cool. And I don't really know what we didn't really know at that point where the movie was going 100%. Hey, that when we first went to Ireland, it was like,
yeah, it was more case of, and Ireland was also, it made sense again to our budget because we were in London,
right?
So it was just a hop. We hired this massive
Winnebago
RV because it's the cheapest way we could get all our gear and everything there. So we drove that overnight on the ferry with Matthew Day and Toby Gidier. And we actually went to go and pick him up because he had a broken back and he had been stuck out there for like 3 months.
Oh, man.
Yeah, he didn't go home, man. He broke his back and then he stayed there. Oh. And kind of like just got on the mend there in some dodgy little hostel.
Brutal, dude.
Yeah, it was not. Well, I mean, the backstory is that Hurley, South Africa, had said that, you know, they're not going to no longer be in South Africa.
Oh.
So I kind of didn't have a job and I had been talking to the guys here and I was like, and I really wanted to sign, carry on doing my job, you know, surfing. So I thought, you know, if I just email the guys here, you know, it's kind of easy to say no in an email.
Sure.
So I was like, my plan was to go to Ireland, have a good season, then go and meet with Pat and Evan and the team and you know, propose, like, pitch to them to be on their team, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I probably should have gone home. but I thought, like, you know, it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to speak to those guys face-to-face. And so I flew there with my back broken.
Wow.
I kind of limped to the office. So, yeah. Yeah, it was pretty...
And it worked out a deal, though, right? I mean...
I did, yeah. Thanks to those guys.
They
had
sympathy for your broken back, maybe.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I swear I'm going to be better. And then, but that kind of whole experience kind of changed my life a little bit, and like the way I look at what I eat and my health and nutrition. And I'd also always been like healthy being a surfer and stuff, but I really like took it to the next level because I was like, I'm not going to let this back problem sort me out, like put me out the water. So I really focus like still a lot of studying on what to eat and what, you know, and in 3 months I was surfing again. So
how much support does Hurley provide for you in that respect in terms of like nutritionists and trainers and things?
None. I'm like a nobody in that team, you know. I'm just a small fish, so I just, and whatever I get from them I'm super grateful for, but I just I'm kind of just traveling and surfing big waves, so it's all up to the individual. But to me, I was like, I even decided for myself before, I thought if they sign me, I'm going to take this as my job and take it as a professional surfer. Mm-hmm. And in that respect, be like as fit as I could possibly be, like have the right equipment and be ready to surf because that's my job.
Sure.
Where before I was kind of hustling, I made a conscious effort to decide that that's what I was going to do.
Yeah. So you did, did you say a month in Mexico as well? I want to. What was the shooting schedule in terms of the surfing? How much time did you spend in each location? And
yeah, like about a month, I think.
Yeah. You spent about 3 months in Ireland.
Ireland, yeah. A month in Mexico in Pascuales with Andy. Hawaii was tough. With just trying to get footage, man, it was got some waves of Jaws and stuff, but there was just so many people out, and like we didn't have a dedicated guy because we didn't have budget for it. So
just buying footage off people,
or just, but it's not, there wasn't buying that was a problem because I got waves. It was more like there was so many waves ridden, and you know, people look the same on a big wave, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a matter of like after surfing the whole day, like going to people and be like, hey, do you think you got my wave? Like, do you think we could get it? Are we making the surf form? I'm sure like every surfer says the same thing, you know, we're making a surf form.
Yeah.
So like to try and get that footage was pretty tough.
To get the photographer to actually sort through all of the clips and find you and then follow
clips.
Up.
Yeah. And then for what, you know,
like, and then they're shooting 3 or 4 days in a row during a swell.
Exactly. So that part of it was actually really hard.
Eric Knudsen came to the party
Eric Knudsen, and I was staying with LB, so his film Dan.
Yeah.
Those guys really helped us out.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And those guys are doing amazing things over there in terms of video production.
Yeah.
Incredible, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, John's a really good friend of mine, so it was good to have his support in that regard, you know?
See, that's interesting. I didn't know that the surf footage, by and large, was cobbled together after the fact. I assume that you just sent a team and went and executed trips like a normal surf
trip. Well, the thing is, with big wave surfing, and a lot of, I have this all the time, it's like, you know, before I left, there's obviously a lot of interest in the film, and they're like, oh, when are you going to go surf dungeons again? Like, is it going to be good next week? And we like, I was like, it hasn't been good for 2 years.
It didn't break the whole time.
Like, you can't just... That's the thing with big wave surfing. You can't just, like, schedule a shoot, and it's going to be on those days, and you can have these people, and you can try 100 times. It's like one day, maybe 2 waves that you get that are good, you know? It's like, it's like throughout a year period. So getting those A-grade, like, surf big wave clips are really difficult, and that's why, you know, that island thing, I was pretty... I still sometimes get a little bit upset about it because I was really prepared and was to get that wave, you know, like done everything I could, and then it's a little bit obviously you don't do it for the footage, but like when you have such a big like team and movie and all we needed was a surf film, I did feel a little personal pressure that I wanted to get surf, you know, like
totally.
So it was a little bit frustrating, but I mean, I'm stoked with the way it came out. Everyone said the surfing is fine, so
absolutely
cool.
So
I broke my back.
Yeah.
Then
can you explain the wipeout itself? Like, I think the broken back, we can't just glaze over that. That's a pretty important detail.
Yeah, no, I got sucked over the fours at Riley's and kind of landed seated on the ground and broke my L2 vertebrae and
landed seated on the ground, but the reef. Yeah, just like got piled dry.
Yeah, like that. And it sucked, man.
Well, I heard in the interview you did with Surfer that you were concerned you didn't have health insurance.
No,
I didn't
have health insurance.
So how
still
did that
didn't
sort
have health
itself
insurance. Well, I don't know. I just I knew I couldn't afford a helicopter, and I was able to stand, so I figured I could walk out the cliff, you know. And then when I got to the hospital, actually Pete was like, "Dude, did they give you an MRI?" I'm like, "Yeah, I've had 2 MRIs." Like, "Bro, do you know how much an MRI costs?" And I was like, I don't know, man. Like, he's like, how are you going to pay for that? I was like, I'm going to run out of here. I don't know. And like, you know, I've been like super fortunate my whole life. I don't know. I have had some really interesting things go my way. And somehow the hospital was like free healthcare.
Oh, no way.
Yeah. And I was like, they just like, when I had to leave, they're like, see you later, Frank. Nice. Thanks for stopping by. Like, it was
crazy.
Just like, out of there, bro.
What did you do en route to the hospital for painkillers?
Oh, yeah. I drank a couple of beers.
No way.
Yeah, I drank like 6 beers. I don't know what to do. It was freezing cold in Ireland. And then, like, we got to the hospital, and it was a crazy, like, public hospital. There was hundreds of people outside, and they're like, you know, take a number. And I was like, wow. It's like,
hundreds of people.
There was just so brilliant. It was like, there was beds everywhere. Like, people, there weren't enough beds. There's people like,
crazy.
Ireland's a poor country, man. Like, people, they have high unemployment, and you know, it's tough there.
Yeah,
they were really hit hard by the recession too. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, there's no ways I'm standing in a queue. I was like, just take me to the front. I'll just lie on my back, you know, like in front of the hospital. Like, someone's got to come get me. And I did that. And I just kind of tried to make like a scene. Like, I was like, maybe a little bit of screaming, and they all ran out. And I'm like, have you been drinking? And I was like, yeah, I drank a little bit for the pain. They were like, what do you mean you drank for the pain?
They didn't believe it.
They didn't believe it.
They thought he was trying to get free meat.
Yeah, my friends were laughing, and the nurse like pulled my friend aside and was like, hey, like, are you hurt? There's a lot of sick people here. Or you just trying to get like free painkillers and drugs and stuff? And I was like, no, I swear my back's sore. And they put me in a neck thing. And I was like, it's not my neck. And I like ripped it off. And then when they took me to get the x-ray, and I was like, I was still a little bit buzzed from the beers, like chatting. And then the lady's like, don't move. And I was like, what? She's like, I'm not like allowed to tell you what's wrong with you, but you do not move off this bed. And then the doctor had to like review the thing. And he was on like, hey, like, this is serious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So had you been able to take your wetsuit off?
Yeah, I took my wetsuit off. Yeah.
That alone, I would figure would be a nightmare.
That was really tough.
Yeah, yeah. Cut it off.
Yeah. So yeah, and then so that whole, you know, we were supposed to film the fight scene. I was supposed to have sponsorship. Like, that was like 3 days in hospital was like pretty low point. And then carrying on, and the next year went back to Ireland with Pete for the film, and I got that one like pretty yeah, one of the best waves of my life, and I end up winning like a big wave event at home through that wave, a video entry event. So that kind of came full circle for me, you know. I broke my back there, and then I came back and won like biggest barrel of the year. So it was pretty that for me was like real high point of the form.
Awesome.
Yeah.
You were talking about your career outlook prior to the film release, or prior to even starting the film project. What does your career outlook look like now?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, I was trying to do the Big Wave World Tour, and I was like, I think I was like 10th in the world, 2012, 13 or something, and that was definitely my path. But now I think my path has shifted. I don't know. I kind of like obscure, like remote places, like Ireland, where there's no people, and I want to do more stuff like that, and kind of go even more off the beaten path, you know, go some tours with like 20, 30 of the best guys, like that. Stressed me out being in those kind of lineups, and I tend not to do so well in those kind of situations. So, yeah, I don't know.
Well, what does it look like in terms of industry support, do you think? I guess the film hasn't been released yet, but you'll see a difference, I would imagine.
Hurley spoke to Pat, and yeah, they're going to carry on looking after me, which is cool.
Yeah.
And through Pete and Flo, the other guy, like I've had some opportunities at Red Bull as well.
Yeah.
Kind of talking about some cool projects to do with them, with like traveling and surfing and stuff. So yeah, it's been cool, man.
How old are you?
33.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I think you'll see a lot of opportunity once the film comes out. I mean, I would imagine the film winning Surfer Paul Awards and all that sort of stuff. It's that remarkable.
Thanks, man.
So
thanks.
Yeah, you should be able to ride it.
We're pretty worried about that.
We're gunning for
Surfer Paul, yeah.
We're excited to try and get it in there.
I don't know how it could be overlooked. I mean, it's...
I mean, for me, though, I'm not too worried about it, you know?
Sure.
Kind of just... this has been, like, such a high point. Like, if I stop tomorrow, like, Pete and I made this incredible film, like, you know, for two South African guys, like Surfer posted it, Surfer Magazine, Stab, Surfline, Surfing, Huck, Wavescape, Zigzag, Carve Mag, Magic Seaweed, like pretty much every surf site, media outlet has spoken about the film. And I don't know, for two people from like remote part of Africa, the bottom of Africa, it's pretty crazy for us, you know? Do you think?
Like, yeah, totally. I think we're totally humbled by it. I said it last night, like, the first surf film I ever saw was freaking Bruce Brown, and Pat O'Connell was in the film, and I just loved that.
Yeah.
And for us to have been standing in California with Californians and Pat O'Connell in the film, man, that blew my mind.
Totally.
Yeah, it was
just incredible.
Yeah.
It's like,
for me and my podcast, like, the story here is two guys from relative anonymity, you know, like I've heard Frank's name before, but I don't know that I'd be able to pick you out from a lineup if I saw you. Two guys from relative anonymity showing up with a film that I hadn't even heard of the pre-production. Like when John was working on his film, I heard about it for 2 years before I saw it. This, it's like it showed up a few weeks ago on Stab. I saw an article. I'm like, what's this? And then I watch it 2 weeks later and I was like, well, the landscape has changed. Like, two guys, relative anonymity, showing up, blowing up, changing everything. This is the model that people have to follow now. So, yeah, I'm impressed.
Thanks, man.
It's a great story.
Blows my mind.
Yeah, that's cool.
Emotional.
Yeah. I think it's also to do with, like, South Africa. I don't know. Like, South African people I don't know. Like, you kind of have to be a hustler if you come from in South Africa, you know? Like,
I think
we're kind of raised that way, you know?
Sure.
It's like a third world country, and it's definitely not... Like this.
No.
So, yeah, I mean, it's cool.
Yeah.
It's cool. Not just two guys, though. We've had such a cool core crew team and a core team. Like, the guys that you mentioned is, like, Andrew McKay. He came on as, like, a creative director as well. And he's, like, he gave up his job in London for 6 months, and we didn't shoot once for the film.
Wow.
Like, just favors. And Matthew Day and Toby Goodyear and Frankie Fogg, Zora Walter, Florian, who was the first guy to believe in it. Then we got Ben Harper and Jason and Jesse involved, and they wrote four amazing songs for the film. I mean, are you kidding me?
Like, did Ben score it or just wrote some of the songs? Or?
No, so the whole film's scored by different artists, but he wrote, they scored five songs for the entire film.
Got it.
Jason Mazeski, J.C. Ingles and Ben Hopper. Right. So
that for us, like, also Ben Hopper for us was like when we were growing
grew up.
Up
as Grom,
you know, that's like Sugar Man, that movie. Like Ben Hopper was kind of like that at home. You know?
Ben Hopper goes to South Africa now, he'd have the biggest turnout.
Really
super popular. People love him over there.
Yeah, so like, you know, even my friends were like, I showed them like Ben Hopper clip, and they're like, dude, I can't believe he says your name. Like, I don't know. It's like, it's a big deal for us.
We went to watch him at the Hollywood Bowl the other day as well, and it was just unbelievable. And we went backstage and hung out with the band afterwards, and man, such a humble guy. Like, Ben is amazing, and same with Jason and Jesse. Like, to see them playing to the Hollywood Bowl.
Yeah.
And then they were involved in our small movie.
It's so crazy, amazing, man. Yeah. How great is that venue, by the way?
Oh, it's
the Hollywood Bowl.
Really?
So rad.
Freak, it's amazing, man. It's like picnics and everything.
No way.
Then you know what?
Lots of people?
Yeah, loads. Like 20,000. Wow. Yeah. It's amazing. Also, all the way, like, and we were talking about this last night, but all the way, the detail kind of, I think, flows all the way down to the posters. I don't know if you've seen our posters.
Yes.
Now, that's, again, from a friend of mine who actually used to be at Stellenbosch University with me. He runs a studio called Studio Muti in Cape Town. And unbelievable what they've done with that. Like, the
hand-painted.
Hand-painted, kind of.
Four different varieties,
four
right?
Four different varieties for each thing, yeah.
Well, that's what I was saying. My very first question was, like, the execution from inception to final delivery, all of it is seamless, down to the posters. Yeah, the posters are what spurred that thought for me.
Yeah.
You know?
That's awesome. So that was it. We just wanted to kind of sell it to the world correctly. And also Andrew McKay has been watching out for that as well, making sure that from a creative execution with all our graphics and everything that we push, that we have that continuity.
Right.
And
he even with the logo, like when I had my broken back, he was trying to get the logo. He must have drawn the logo 1,000 times.
Yeah. Right.
Like, it was like piles of power. I was like sleeping in paper. Yeah. Let's be frank. And to me, it looked every single one looked exactly the same.
Yeah.
Right.
And he's like, oh, this one. I was like, that looks just like that one.
Yeah.
He plays Andy in the film. Yeah.
He's actually in the film.
Right.
And that was also just by chance. Like, once we got him in front of the camera, I wanted to maybe use him once or twice, and once I got him in front of the camera, I was like, dude, you look so good in front of the camera. We're gonna blend this in more. And then we sat down and just wrote, and I just wrote and kind of wrote him into the plot much thicker. He was gonna maybe do one little thing for us, and then I kinda conned him into doing the whole thing.
We kinda conned everyone.
I thought he was brilliant in it, and
so good.
The fact that I even knew that was the Andy was because I researched it. I saw him in the film, and I thought he was a professional actor. I was like, who is this guy? He's nailing it. And like, they lucked out by getting him. And then I looked at the credits, and I was like, what? How'd that work out?
I think also Josh Redman.
Amazing.
Yeah, the guy, he's like one of my best friends. And yeah, he nailed it.
Yeah,
unbelievable, man. That day of filming with Pat and with Josh, I think we got the scene in one take.
Yeah.
They were incredible.
So in my notes, I had my two kind of the most impactful scenes and sequences in the film were the fight scene and that scene.
Yeah.
With the Lincoln Continental out in the desert.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a beautiful, beautiful sequence.
Man. And you know what? You know what? What I learned massively. Someone said to me, like, wow, the production value is massive in this. You can see it just looks epic. And what I've learned massively is that locations. Location, 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 dude. It is that's what it's your environment. It's like, and California has the most amazing locations to shoot. Like, we shot out at Four Aces, which in that scene, and it's just incredible. It lends such a richness to it. So anything I do now is really just research locations, because they are so important. All the locations we used in this film were incredible. Like, we used castles in England or manor houses in England. And we put the effort into kind of sourcing the best we could.
Right.
And I think that the same also with the pool scene when the girl's walking through. Just dressing it correctly, having the right location, having the right player. Don't, whatever you do for any other filmmakers, I wouldn't shortchange yourself there. That's where I'd put the effort in.
And they've shot what film they shot at Four Aces? Like Independence Day, I think?
Oh, yeah, they shot loads there. Like Lady Gaga music videos and stuff. Yeah. And then we used the Kill Bill Church as well for the one scene.
Oh, is that right? In Mexico?
Yeah. And we didn't even go in it. We just used it as a backdrop because it was so powerful. It's such a powerful
Yeah.
Visual, you know?
Yeah, this fascinating.
The scene's up for like 1 second.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And then it's your color palette as well that you choose. Like, what kind of walls are painted?
Of course.
Like, it's so important. Like, that kind of detail is just awesome. Yeah. That's a lot. I learned a lot of that from Matthew Day as well. Like,
okay.
Because he's done a lot of stuff. He's done a lot more than I have. And we're kind of super kind of detailed on that.
Yeah. I loved it. It was very impactful.
Awesome.
Let's talk about distribution. Where will the film end up? On the 19th, when it's released, where can people get it?
Yeah, go to Red Bull TV.
Red Bull TV, 19th of September, and then it's up for 10 days, I think.
Yeah, and then I think the 25th it goes on iTunes.
Okay.
25th of September goes on iTunes, yeah. And we've got our soundtracks on iTunes already. Like,
oh, really?
Ben Harper, it's called Let's Be Frank. So Ben Harper, iTunes, yeah, there's a track
there. Yeah.
Okay, sweet. So when it's on Red Bull, it'll be available for free for those 10 days?
That's it.
Amazing. 10-day
free viewing, and then iTunes after that. So everyone would have seen it by the time it goes on iTunes, so no one will buy a film.
I know. I wonder about that strategy, actually. But amazing of Red Bull to do that. I mean, yeah. They've been producing the best surf media since they started.
Yeah. The guys that we deal with from Red Bull are just such great guys. Like Florian Moser, who was here earlier, and then Philip Mandela. Incredible guys. Like, yeah. Philip, he lives and breathes surfing. He made his first surf film a couple of years ago as well, and they're just super passionate. And those are the two guys who really actually believed in the project and put up the initial funds. Because without them and without their pocket of funds, we wouldn't have been able to do this.
Sure,
we would still be kind of trying to hustle. It would probably take us 5 years to make the film. We would have made it, but it would take a lot longer.
Yeah, I think that was also your thing. Hey, you were going to make it no matter what. Like, Pete was like, even if we don't film for like 3 years, we don't have any money, we're going to still do it, but it's just going to take a lot of while, you know?
Right.
And that's stressful, man. When you've got like everybody, like Frank, especially because he's like, he has this tenacity and he doesn't let things lie. He's on at me all the time. When are we doing this? When are we doing that?
Right.
And it just becomes stressful, like with all the people in the party. So
It's
hard, man, when you've got a lot of people involved in something and they're giving up their jobs and their lifestyle to accommodate you. It's a stressful process. So it's rad that it's finished and bucketed down now.
And I commend you for actually allowing those people to get involved. I think as somebody who's directing, it's easy to micromanage.
Yeah.
But to understand that those people have assets that you might not have and they're willing to donate their time, it's huge.
Yeah,
this couldn't have come together without it being a collaboration.
Yeah, I was never like that. I was very much... Before I would keep everything to myself.
That's how creative people are.
I would never show anyone anything. And through this process, I've just there's people that are a million times better at things that I'm not good at. And that's where we've got all the right people involved that made it.
Well, so did you actually enlist outside production companies to do any of the transitions or the titles or the animation? And
no, so Red Bull, we did all our finishing at Red Bull Media House in Austria.
Got it.
So there's a team there that helped us with like those eye transitions shots and stuff. And then there was another freelance animator that I brought in as well.
Okay.
Darian, who came and did another sequence. That sequence where you say he's got big balls.
Yeah.
That sequence, yeah.
Okay.
That
got a good laugh the other night.
Yeah. It's so funny, man. People laughed at the rock time.
Good.
That was incredible. Like, I think you don't want to take yourself too serious. And that scene with Pat when he lifts his head.
Yeah.
And the people laughed. That's what we're supposed to get. It wasn't supposed to be serious, although it looks creatively like serious.
Right.
But the fact that everyone laughed, that was it.
The moment you see it's Pat, you gotta laugh.
Yeah, exactly.
So awesome. So, in closing, what's next for each of you?
Yeah.
I'm taking a sabbatical for 5 years. There's some talk about some projects in the future projects that I'm talking with some guys about, but at the moment I'm finishing off Ripple Effect because I've still got that 6 more episodes to do, and those will be finished by October. Some downtime would be good, because I think for future creative projects you really need time to kind of just consolidate, and you need like a clear head. And I think with lots of stuff going on, it's hard to kind of get that kind of creative time. So I'm looking for some downtime, but I'm not sure we'll have much of it.
Well, when you say you have potential projects that you're talking to people about, have people approached you based on the success of this?
Not based on the success of it, but because they haven't seen it yet. But they were out there. I had close conversations with them as we were making it, and mm-hmm. I was showing them some scenes. Okay. And yes, it is. It's okay. There's opportunities that are arising from that
in the surf world or outside.
Inside and outside.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. So there have been a few opportunities that have come around, and yeah, we're just looking at them and just kind of making the right call. I don't want to get into the position that I've been in the last 2 years where I'm juggling so many balls. Like, I think the next project that I want to do, I want to just be committed to just that project. And,
great.
And I've got an amazing production production team behind me in London that run my production company, and giving them more responsibility to take on bigger projects and stuff, and we're growing that so that I can just focus on kind of one thing, and that's kind of what I want to do. So
smart. It's so easy to spread yourself thin, yeah, especially exactly. when offers start coming.
Yeah.
So are you based out of London?
I'm based out of London, yes. Okay. Well, at the moment, halfway between London and America, but just depending on what happens with the ripple effect and right. what happens with other opportunities, we've got a house and our production companies in London.
Okay. And Frank, any big plans for you in the immediate horizon? Are you still doing the Big Wave World Tour?
No, I'm not. I'm not in any events this year, I don't think. No, I kind of... It was hard to... do both for the yeah. last couple of years. Like, it's hard enough because the Big Wave contest, like, you have 24 hours notice, 48 hours. So like,
right.
if we had like a shoot, like, I just wouldn't have, couldn't like. Well, I did it once. I think I went to Ireland. I went to Chile.
Chile, yeah.
Yeah, I was shot in London, and then they called the contest on like while I was in the plane, and kind of met my dad at the airport. No, we were in Cape Town, I think.
Yeah, something like that. You're in Cape Town.
I was in Cape Town. And then I was home for like one day, and I had to go to Chile. So
yeah,
I got there at like 4 in the morning, and the contest started at 6. My boards hadn't arrived. Nothing arrived. Stress. It was just like, yeah.
The funniest thing is when you're shooting, we'd be shooting sets and stuff like that in London in the cold, and the waves would be firing like in Hawaii. And Frank's like, dude, the waves are really good here. We should be here. Like, why are we doing this stuff in the studio? Like, I'm like, dude, just, we got to do it.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure you've seen it, like, if with Frank and with surfers in general, like, if they can't get to that wave, they get irritated.
Yeah, totally.
We also had that problem in Hawaii, because the one day I was like, hey, John, like, we got to do this. Like, he was, like, happy to do it, and I've been rushing him, and he's not very good at replying to emails and stuff. So then we went to Hawaii, and Pete's like, is John going to do it? Is he going to do it? And I was like, yeah, he's going to do it. He's like, he's not replying to any of my mails. I'm like, nah, don't worry about it, right? He said he'll do it. He's a good kid, you know? And then the one day we like organized Jamie O'Brien's dad's house. These guys set up this huge, like, that amazing set that they put up with the map and stuff. That was
where all of his narration was done.
Yeah. So that we set up that whole, like,
yeah,
scene, you know?
Yeah, that map came from America, like, we flew it in and did everything.
Wow.
And but that day the waves of pipe were firing, so
I was like
and there was a bunch of guys in the front of Jamie's dad's house, like, getting
hooting
drinking beers, and then when obviously John arrives, it's like a big deal. John's there, and some guy's like, hey man, look how good are the waves, and John's like, hey Frank, how are the waves right now, because we did it for like a couple hours, like him talking to Cam, you know, doing the lines, and he's like, hey, how are the waves? And I just saw like the sickest wave of pipe, and I was like, yeah, I think the wind's a bit bad, you know.
He's smoke screening John at pipe.
we got to keep him.
We had him in there. Oh my gosh, Pete's like, oh, you're just gonna be quick, you say a couple lines. Pete comes out a pile of paper like this thick of lines, like the whole movie in paper. I'm like, Pete, you can't expect the guy to read the whole film, you know?
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, just one more. Okay, just one more, Frank. Okay, one more. And John, like, it's getting like a little bit like, okay.
Like, you know, we're in a real production world, dude, that we would have had maybe 2 days to do all of that.
Right.
But with John's time, it was very,
we had like hours.
We had 2 hours.
Oh.
So I was just trying, I was sweating and trying to get...
Yeah, I was sweating, and then
come
we
on, this, we're just...
Yeah. The guy was super drunk, and he was screaming, and we were trying to record sound, and it was like...
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, it turned out.
It came on.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It turned out.
But I don't think I'm going to do the Big Wave.
Yeah.
I'm also, kind of working on a couple... Not working on, but yeah, a couple projects more, and like... Like the video space, kind of, you know, mm-hmm. like couple interested in like travel and things I've been doing anyway, but trying to like showcase it a bit more.
Cool.
And yeah, surf big waves and try to see the world. Yeah.
Cool. Well, you're flying out tomorrow. You were only here for about a week, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So explain to people what your schedule looks like for the next 3 weeks.
Sure. Yeah. Schedule's pretty gnarly. the flight here was 40 hours for me and
from Cape Town.
Yeah. Like 9 hours layover. So the first 2 days I was here, I was just anybody's business. I woke up at like 3 a.m, wide awake. And then I'm not complaining. That's sick, but it's,
yeah,
jet lag's a real thing. It's a part of people that I've never really, put too much thought into it because I've been able to be places longer times, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, short periods is pretty nuts. So we go from here to Johannesburg. We're doing a 3-day media tour. All the media in South Africa, pretty much. Some couple TV shows, radios, newspapers. 3 days of that. Then we go to Cape Town on the 9th of September for the one premiere I'm really excited for. It's my hometown. And,
yeah,
all my friends, everyone's... I've been really excited for that, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of people there, and it sold out in like half an hour.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we go to Durban, Pete's hometown.
Yeah.
The Barnyard Theatre.
Yeah, it's going to be huge.
Pretty amazing theatre there. And then we go to London on the 15th. Where is it in London?
London's in at the Curzon in Shaftesbury Avenue, where they do a lot of big premieres and stuff. So we've got an amazing spot there.
And then the next day we go to Spain to the San Sebastian Film Festival, where I think now they're doing 2 screenings of the film.
Yeah.
So we're there for 4 days, yeah. And then, yeah, from there I'm going straight to Ireland to go surf for a month.
Cool.
Yeah.
Full circle back to Ireland. Final question for everybody that's interviewed on the podcast is just, what was the last surfboard that you rode?
The last surfboard I rode? What did I ride? I rode a 511 Paisalian
at
Llandudno, my local break. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you haven't surfed here since you've been here?
I haven't. I'm actually going tomorrow. I couldn't to bring like a board all the way here for a surf. It's just crazy. I'm staying with my good friend Greg Long, and he's got lots of boards. So
totally.
I'm just staying with him.
Whose boards do you normally ride?
Paisal.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. You grow up surfing in South Africa? Or
yes,
what's your background?
Yeah, 100%. But I was actually talking to Joe G about it at the premiere. It's like normally the worst surfer in the group becomes the filmer because he's one of those best on the beach.
So. I've spent plenty of time filming. I know that plight.
I've surfed my whole life and I absolutely love it, but I'm not exceptional, as my friends will stand testament to that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, what's the last board that you rode?
Catch Surf Soft Top.
Oh, I see it right there. So you've been able to surf out here a little bit.
Yes, yeah. Well, when I get a chance, yeah, I have been. And just in front here, we've got an amazing... I get in the sea every day because it's amazing shore break over here.
Yeah.
Just in front.
Yeah, totally.
And I've got an Almeric over there as well.
Yeah.
But I don't really...
it takes a bit more energy and effort to ride that.
Exactly, man.
But I think, you can get just as much enjoyment in surfing like that. Sometimes,
oh, dude,
like when surfing becomes your job, it also puts a different spin on it, you know? It's like...
Totally.
Is like something that was just passion becomes what you have to do.
Yeah.
It's kind of a weird
thing for photography and everything.
Exactly,
Exactly. So. I don't even like take digital photos anymore,
right?
Just because it became very kind of tedious.
Right.
And now I actually got myself a Leica M3, old school, and it's like it's kind of brought the romance for photography back.
Yep.
You don't know what you've taken, like.
Yep.
And 90% of the photos you take will be crappy.
Yep.
And then you'll have to kind of figure it out. There's more of a science to it, which I really enjoy.
So, Interesting. Awesome. Well, I'm glad to connect with you guys. Like I said, I wanted to get a hold of you the other night, and I was like, you know what? You guys are overwhelmed with attention and people. I'll try to catch you in the morning. But I'm glad to catch you at the beginning of your media tour as well,
because
you're
going to
be telling the same stories for 3 weeks straight.
I'm sure.
No, it's cool, and it's cool that you appreciated the film like it was meant to be appreciated. You know, a lot of people just think it like, oh, look, that's cool film, you know, but just that you realize, you know, everything that went into it. Kind of,
Years I've been begging for something of interest with narrative, with production value, so.
Maybe we should start like a hashtag, like listen and surf the pole or something.
I'll start it for you among our listeners.
Okay, cool. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you, man.
Right. Appreciate
the effort in coming through.
Let's Be Frank is available on redbull.tv for free up until September 29th, 2016, and then be available in perpetuity on iTunes for purchase from that point on. Thank you, Frank Solomon and Peter Hamblin. Beautiful work. Thank you to my loyal listeners for persevering another hour of Surf Splendor. If you enjoyed this episode, I encourage you to share it with a friend. You know what? Share this episode and share the film with a friend. What a great friend you will be to them by doing those things. It's all free, man. Free podcast, free movie. Amazing. So much good content out there right now for free. So anyways, do that for me because I will tell you what, I'm happy to produce the content as long as people are listening. And the more listeners we have, the more likely we can attract amazing guests like these guys. We're trying to get to Kelly Slater, folks. Let us get to Kelly. Anybody out there that knows him personally, send him this episode. Tell him we want him on the pod. He'll be the ultimate guest, and then I could just quit completely. Go away. Live happily ever after. All right? That is all for now. SurfSplendorPodcast.com is our website where you can see clips from Let's Be Frank and some of the still imagery that was captured on the production. And past episodes are all available. Every episode out of the archive, 135 past episodes, are all available for free. There's actually a music page that archives every song ever used in every episode of Surf Splendor if you've ever been curious and didn't happen to have Shazam handy at that moment. It's all available, surfsplendorpodcast.com. There's also a comment section where you are welcome to chime in about today's show or any past show. I will make sure to read that and get back to you with my response to whatever you have to say and share. Thank you very much. Again, I am but your humble host, David Scales, signing off for Surf Splendor, reminding you to get in the ocean, get a couple waves, and shred on.